Hello and welcome back everyone to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl Holly and I am back today with another solved murder case to share. Today's case is a wonderful reminder to never give up hope that your loved one will be found or that their murder can be solved. We are seeing more and more cases solved decades later and it makes me so incredibly happy. And while many of them are due to advances in science and genetic genealogy tracking down these bad guys, some of them are due to families and investigators who never gave up the search. And that is exactly how this case was solved 25 years later. People never gave up on digging, literally, for the answers on what happened to her. I don't have any kind of case updates to give or any Patreon shoutouts to do this week, so we are just going to get straight into things. Today's episode is on the disappearance and murder of Kimberly Langwell. Kimberly Ann Langwell was born on February 24, 1975 in Houston, Texas. While not much is publicly known about her early childhood, we do know that Kimberly had a sister named Susan. By July of 1999, Kimberly was living in Beaumont, Texas, where she was raising her 15-year-old daughter Tiffany as a single mother. Tiffany described her life back then as pretty typical for a teenager, but what stood out most was her relationship with her mom. The two were incredibly close, best friends. They did everything together. Tiffany wasn't just part of Kimberly's life, she was the center of it. There's very little information about Tiffany's father, and from what's been shared, it appears that Kimberly was raising Tiffany on her own, and she worked hard to do it. At times, Kimberly held multiple jobs, sometimes up to three, just to make sure her daughter had everything she needed. That kind of dedication says a lot about who she was. Kimberly was the kind of mom who would do whatever it took, even if that meant long days and late nights, just to give her daughter the best life possible. And honestly, that's something to admire. But Kimberly wasn't just a devoted mother, she was also a loyal friend. People who knew her consistently described her as kind, warm, and someone who was always there when you needed her. Over the years, Kimberly dated and had a few serious relationships, but none of them led to marriage. About 6 months before her disappearance, she ended a long-term relationship. But despite that, things in her life seemed to be falling into place. She had a job she genuinely enjoyed, working at a local chemical plant. And it was there that she met someone new, Ken Weatherford. By all accounts, their relationship was strong, healthy, and happy. For the first time in a very long time, Kimberly seemed truly content. Friends said things between them were getting serious, so much so that Kimberly had even started wearing a faux engagement ring. The two took a trip to Mexico together, and Ken was building a relationship with Tiffany as well. And let's be honest, winning over a teenage daughter, especially after past relationships haven't worked out, that's not always easy. But somehow, Ken did it. He and Tiffany got along great. And for Kimberly, that meant everything. Because Tiffany did not like her mom's ex-boyfriend, Terry, and she wasn't quiet about it either. Terry was the man that Kimberly had been dating before Ken, the relationship that she ended 6 months before she disappeared. According to Tiffany, Terry could be forceful with her mom, often reminding her that he was the one that was in control. And that's important to remember because we're going to come back to that a little bit later. Now, going back to our timeline here, On July 9, 1999, 34-year-old Kimberly worked her day shift at the chemical plant. That evening, she had plans: dinner with her daughter and her boyfriend, Ken, something that they had been looking forward to for days. After getting off work around 5 p.m., Kimberly called Tiffany to remind her to get ready, and Tiffany said that she would be at home waiting. Before heading home, Kimberly mentioned that she needed to stop by Terry's house to help him with something. She told Tiffany that she'd be home before Ken arrived. Around 6:30 p.m., Ken pulled up to Kimberly's house to pick them up for dinner, but Kimberly wasn't there. So Ken and Tiffany waited, expecting her to walk through the door at any moment, but she never did. At first, it didn't seem like a reason to panic. Maybe she got caught up helping Terry. Maybe something just took longer than expected. Tiffany tried calling her mom and paging her 911, but there was no response. They waited, hoping that any second she would walk through the door with an explanation. Maybe there had been an emergency and she stopped to help. Maybe she ran into someone and lost track of time. But none of that really sounded like Kimberly. Because if she was going to be late, if she wasn't going to make it somewhere, she would have called. There was no doubt about that. By 10 p.m., with still no sign of her, Ken told Tiffany that he was headed home. But instead, he was actually going out to look for Kimberly. After driving around for a while, around 10:30, he spotted her 1994 Nissan Altima sitting alone in a parking lot of the Eckerd's drugstore off of Dallin and Phelan Road. At that time of night, the parking lot was mostly empty, so Kimberly's car stood out immediately. Ken walked up to it, looked inside, thinking that maybe she was resting or something had happened. But the car was empty, and nothing looked out of place. No signs of a struggle, nothing that immediately raised concerns. Trying to make sense of it, Ken thought maybe someone Kimberly knew had picked her up. Maybe she changed her plans and simply forgot to call. So after finding her car and not seeing anything obviously wrong, he went home for the night. But the next morning, when he called Tiffany and learned that Kimberly still hadn't come home, that was when everything changed, because now there was no reasonable explanation left. She wouldn't have left Tiffany home alone. Ken told Tiffany that he didn't want to tell her, but the night before, he actually found her mom's car at the Eckerd's parking lot and said that it was time to call police, because something had to be wrong. Tiffany did something that no teenage girl should ever have to do. She called the Beaumont Police Department and reported her mom as missing. After that call, Tiffany and her Aunt Susan rushed to the Eckerd's, where they met officers. When they looked inside Kimberly's car, a few things immediately stood out. Her briefcase was there, her phone was there, but her purse, her wallet, and her keys were gone. And the car itself was left locked. There was no clear explanation as to why Kimberly's car would be sitting in that parking lot. Investigators began talking to anyone they could, hoping someone had seen something, anything, but no one had. At first, authorities floated the idea that maybe Kimberly had walked away and started a life somewhere new. But that theory didn't last long, because after speaking with the people who knew her best, it became clear Kimberly would never do that to her daughter. So investigators shifted their thinking. Maybe after leaving Terry's house, Kimberly stopped at Eckerd's to pick something up and she just didn't mention it. After all, she was an adult and she didn't need to give a play-by-play of what she was going to be doing to anyone. And maybe while she was there, something happened. Maybe she was taken from the parking lot. But even that didn't fully add up, because the location of that store didn't make sense. If Kimberly had left Terry's house and was heading home, Eckerd's wasn't on the way. She would have had to have gone out of her way to stop there when there were other, more convenient places that she could have gone. It just didn't fit. Investigators also considered the possibility that someone Kimberly knew had picked her up from the parking lot, but no one had seen her, no one had heard from her. That theory didn't hold either. Police were able to pull surveillance footage from Eckerd's and other nearby businesses in the shopping center, but none of them showed Kimberly entering any of the stores. And guys, this was 1999. There weren't cameras everywhere like they are today. So there was no footage showing her car pulling into the lot and no way to see who may have gotten out of the car when it got there. With no physical evidence to go on, investigators had to start looking closer at the people in Kimberly's life. And one detail didn't sit well with them. Ken had found Kimberly's car the night before, but he never reported it. And in an investigation like this, everyone has to be considered as a suspect. So police took a good hard look at Ken, but ultimately he was ruled out. And from the very beginning, Kimberly's friends and family didn't believe that he had anything to do with it. They said Kimberly was the happiest she had been in a long time, that she and Ken were truly in love, but they did point investigators in another direction. They told police to take a closer look at Terry Rose, because not only was he the last known person Kimberly was supposed to be seeing before she disappeared, their relationship had a history, and it wasn't a good one. Like I mentioned earlier, Tiffany said that Terry could be forceful with her mom, and that he liked to remind her who was in charge. And it wasn't just Tiffany who had bad things to say. Kimberly's friends said the same thing, that Terry would and could be aggressive with her. But in the beginning, like most relationships like this, things weren't always that way. At first, everything seemed good. Terry was a successful business owner. He ran his own tow trucking company. And on the surface, he seemed like a stable, reliable partner. The two of them dated and even lived together for about 6 years before Kimberly finally ended the relationship. And even after the breakup, they didn't completely cut ties. They still stayed in contact and Kimberly would see him from time to time. But during their relationship, there were signs. Terry was extremely obsessive and possessive. He wanted to know where Kimberly was at all times. If she went over to her friend's house, he would call their house over and over asking where she was, who was all there, when would she be leaving, and what was she doing. And her friends overheard those calls. They saw it firsthand, and it made them feel so uncomfortable. They didn't like the way that he treated her or how he tried to control every aspect of her life. Because that's how it often starts. Things feel good in the beginning, and then slowly that control starts to creep in. The attention turns into monitoring, and before you realize it, it's something else entirely. As the relationship went on, things only got worse. Not long before Kimberly ended things, Terry became physical. Kimberly confided in a close friend that during one incident, Terry held her down on the bed and strangled her until she blacked out. She said in that moment, she truly believed that she was going to die. And Terry had even told Kim on several occasions that if she ever tried to leave him, he would kill her. And Kimberly didn't keep that information to herself. She told her closest friends that if she ever went missing, Terry would likely be responsible, that he might even bury her in the backyard. It was after that incident that Kimberly knew that she had to leave. And because you follow true crime, you already know leaving an abusive relationship is one of the most dangerous times for a survivor, because that's when control is lost and things can escalate quickly. After they broke up, Terry would still nonstop call the house and would even question Tiffany about her mom's whereabouts if she answered the phone. And on many occasions, they would spot Terry lurking outside of their home. Kimberly tried to remain cordial with Terry and didn't want to set him off. From everything that's been shared, it seems like Terry may have believed that the relationship wasn't truly over, that maybe over time he could win Kimberly back. But those feelings were not mutual. And even after the breakup, there were still ways that he tried to maintain a level of control. And one of those ways was through money. Terry had given Kimberly a cell phone that was on his plan that he paid for every month. He would occasionally pay some of her bills without her even asking. And he even gave her $500 for a trip to Mexico. A trip, at the time, Terry believed Kimberly was taking with her girlfriends, not with a new man. And here's where things get interesting. On the day that Kimberly disappeared, she was wearing a shirt that she had bought on that Mexico trip. So you have to wonder, is it a possibility that Terry found out the truth and knew it the day that she went missing? And if he knew, could seeing that shirt have triggered something? Terry was brought in for questioning, and he admitted that their relationship had ended and that towards the end, things weren't good. He said arguments between them were common and that on at least one occasion he had gotten physical with her and slapped her. When investigators asked what Kimberly was doing at his house on the evening of July 9th, Terry said that he asked her to come over to help him with a project. He said that he was in the middle of renovating his home and claimed that he needed her help holding boards in place while he secured them. According to Terry, Kimberly came over shortly after work, stayed for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then left. He said that he hadn't seen or spoken to her since. When asked about the rest of the night, Terry told investigators he stayed home until around 9:30 p.m., and then he went to play pool at a place called the Corner Pocket. But something didn't sit right with investigators. They felt like Terry wasn't being completely truthful, so they asked for permission to search his property, and Terry agreed. On that property, there wasn't just his home. He also ran his tow trucking business out of there, meaning that there were multiple buildings that investigators had to go through. They searched everything, but they found nothing. No sign of Kimberly, no clear evidence of foul play. And while we don't know how thorough the search was, it came up empty. But I will say that the search could have possibly been tough to perform, at least one without a warrant, you know, so they couldn't really dig super deep into things, because Terry's house was a mess. And maybe that was because of renovations, or maybe he was just a pig. I don't know. But they did go through it. They didn't find anything at that time. Terry was asked to take a polygraph test, and he failed. With no evidence to confront Terry with, there wasn't a whole lot that they could do. And even though he failed a polygraph test, that doesn't exactly mean that he's guilty. As we know, polygraphs are inadmissible in court because they're not always accurate and reliable. Obviously, Terry quickly rose to the top of the suspect list, but there was another name that kept coming up as well. And that name was Frank McCormick. In 1999, another name kept popping up in the disappearance of Kimberly Langwell. That name was Frank McCormick, and by all accounts, he made people uneasy. Friends, family, coworkers, and even Ken told investigators they needed to take a closer look at him. Frank was Kimberly's supervisor at the chemical plant, and he made her uncomfortable more than once. In fact, he was described as being completely obsessed with her, which made things even more concerning because Frank was married. He made repeated advances towards Kimberly at work, advances she consistently turned down. He would flirt with her, compliment her, talk about her big, beautiful blue eyes, but it didn't stop there. Frank started showing up in her personal life. He left gifts on her porch, including chocolates from France. Then came the letters, handwritten love letters where he professed his feelings, saying he was in love with her and that something needed to be done about it. And in one of those letters, he admitted something that is honestly so chilling. He said that he would drive past her house 20 to 30 times a week. That's not a crush. That is not harmless. That's a freaking obsession. And that is terrifying. He even told her about a file of letters that he had never got the courage to give to her. And I can only imagine what was written in them. And who knows what other kind of weird stuff he would have said. He even took things one step further and sent her bizarre photo collages of women with Kimberly's face edited onto their bodies. It was unsettling, deeply, deeply unsettling. And I'm going to try and get the photos to share with you guys because those pictures are really weird. They're like gladiator kind of women on horses with Kimberly's face put on it. It's very weird and really disturbing if you ask me. And this obviously bothered Kimberly enough that instead of throwing the letters away, she started saving them, giving them to a close friend for safekeeping. In total, Kimberly received dozens upon dozens of these letters. And you can only imagine how uncomfortable, how uneasy that must have made her feel. But what made the situation even more complicated was the power dynamic. Frank wasn't just some random guy at work, he was her supervisor. And because of that, Kimberly didn't feel like she could report him. So she stayed quiet and just kept handing these letters off to her friend. No matter how politely she turned him down, Frank didn't stop. If anything, his behavior only became more obsessive and more bizarre. It seems like in Frank's mind, Kimberly's kindness meant something more, that she was interested and that he had a chance. When in reality, Kimberly was being nice because she was scared. Scared of what might happen if she wasn't nice. Scared of the retaliation. Scared of losing the job that she worked so hard for and a job that she truly loved. But investigators couldn't ignore the possibility that Frank's obsession had gone too far. Maybe he finally realized Kimberly was never going to reciprocate those feelings and that she might report him. Maybe he was afraid she would tell his wife or expose the letters, the gifts, the behavior that he couldn't explain away. And maybe that fear pushed him to do something irrational. It was reported that Frank was upset about Kimberly's relationship with Ken. They all worked at the same chemical plant, and coworkers noticed the tension. Frank would glare at Ken while they were at work, clearly bothered by their relationship. Ken even said there was one time he was leaving Kimberly's house and noticed Frank parked down the street, sitting in his car, watching. So you have to ask, was this jealousy? Was it obsession? Or was it something more dangerous? Maybe Frank believed that if he couldn't have Kimberly, no one else could. Or maybe his fixation had reached a point where he couldn't control it anymore. There were a lot of scenarios where Frank could have been involved, and investigators needed to rule him out quickly. So they brought him in for questioning. Of course, they asked him about his behavior towards Kimberly, the letters, the gifts, the obvious fixation, but Frank downplayed it. He described it as nothing more than a small little crush, saying that sure, he did admire her, but he insisted it wasn't anything serious. But investigators weren't buying that. They had seen the letters, they had seen the weird photos, and they had spoken to the people in Kimberly's life who described his behavior as unsettling. Frank tried to explain that he would never pursue a subordinate like that, especially as a married man, of course not, and that he would never risk his job or his career. But when it came to the night that Kimberly disappeared, that's where things got more concrete for Frank. Frank told investigators that after work, he went to a local grocery store. He said he was picking up items because he was hosting a poker game at his house that night. He picked up snacks, beer, the usual things that you would expect at one of those games. And he didn't just say it, he backed it up completely. He provided a receipt from the store, timestamped at 6:56 p.m. After that, his timeline was further confirmed by the eight friends who came over for the poker game. So while his alibi wasn't perfect, it was strong. And ultimately, investigators were able to rule him out. Because during the window of time where Kimberly is believed to have disappeared, Frank was standing in a grocery store aisle browsing the chips and dip selection, which meant investigators were right back where they started. Because with Frank ruled out, all eyes went back to Terry. But with so little evidence to go on, the case quickly went cold. And while the investigation stalled, life didn't. Tiffany was forced to continue on without her mom. She had to endure the rest of her teenage years with that unanswered question hanging over her head every single day. And at one point, it became too much. She told her Aunt Susan that she couldn't keep going out doing searches anymore. She just couldn't handle it. Because while everyone else was searching for Kimberly, Tiffany was trying to grow up without her. Kimberly missed everything. She wasn't there for prom. She wasn't in the stands cheering her on at games. She didn't get to watch her walk across the stage and receive her diploma. All of those moments, gone. And you can only imagine how hard that must have been for a teenage girl to experience all of those milestones without her mom by her side. Susan did everything that she could to step in. She was there for Tiffany. She supported her, cared for her, showed up for her in every way that she could. But no matter how much love she gave, it wasn't the same. Kimberly was missing, and Tiffany felt her absence so deeply. Still, the family didn't give up. They kept pushing and pushing for answers. And investigators continued working the case with what little they had. But one thing that was a red flag was Terry's behavior. From the very beginning, he didn't seem concerned that Kimberly was missing. And that's a stark contrast to how he acted before. Because prior to her disappearance, he was constantly around, watching, questioning, and keeping tabs, even asking her teenage daughter about her whereabouts. But once Kimberly vanished, that all stopped completely. He also never helped search for her. And think about that for a second. If someone you had been with for 6 years, someone you were still involved with, disappeared after leaving your house, a normal person would be out there doing everything they could to find them, but not Terry. About 3 weeks after Kimberly went missing, her sister Susan went to Terry's house to talk, to try to make sense of everything. But instead of concern, instead of empathy, his response was something else entirely. He said to her, quote, "Well, how do you think I felt when I found out I gave her $500 and she went to Mexico with another man?" End quote. And that moment, that response felt off. The timing didn't make sense. It came across less like grief and more like anger, like something he hadn't let go of. And when someone is missing, when a family is desperate for answers, that kind of response doesn't just stand out. It raises a whole slew of other questions. And for decades, those questions would go unanswered. In 2023, the TV show Cold Justice took a fresh look at Kimberly's case. They teamed up with the Beaumont detectives to re-examine everything, and thankfully, they did. After going through the case file, they came to the same conclusion many had suspected for years. Terry Rose was likely involved in Kimberly's disappearance. So they knew that they needed to talk to him again. But at this point, it had been more than 20 years since he had last spoken to investigators. When they showed up at Terry's house, the same house that he had lived in back in 1999, he didn't answer the door, even though his car was sitting right there in the driveway. They knocked. They called out to him, saying that they just wanted to talk. They knocked some more, but nothing. So they made their way around the back of the property, and that's when they saw him. Terry was trying to leave out a back exit on his property in his old beat-up truck. Detectives quickly got in their car and intercepted him before he could get away. At that point, he agreed to talk. And right away, they called him out, asking him why he was trying to leave when they were clearly at his front door. But Terry played it off. He was cool about it. He said he didn't hear them knocking. And if you guys could see this episode, I will have the details of it in the description. The episode of Cold Justice, you will see exactly how he was acting. It doesn't feel believable at all. He's a terrible liar, terrible actor. And it feels like it was someone that was trying to cover their tracks. During the conversation, Terry stuck to his original story. He said Kimberly came over for about 15 to 20 minutes and then she left. Later that night, he said he went to go play pool with a friend. He was adamant that he had nothing to do with her disappearance. And when investigators asked if he had ever put his hands on Kimberly, he responded by saying that any man who would do that to a woman was a quote-unquote pussy. Which we know, he was one of those men way back when. When he talked to authorities this time, though, there was one detail that had changed. This time, Terry claimed that Kimberly had come over to pick up some of her belongings that she had left at his house, when previously he told investigators that she had come over to help him with renovations. And that inconsistency mattered. So detectives decided to take a closer look at the person Terry said he was with that night, a man named David Wiley. David had been questioned years earlier, but nothing had really come from it. Now, sitting in the front seat of a detective's car in 2023, they started asking him those questions once again. They asked him directly, did he think that Terry had anything to do with Kimberly's disappearance? And David said no, he didn't think Terry was that kind of person. But something about his demeanor just didn't sit right with investigators. Something was off, clearly. It felt like he wasn't being fully honest, like he knew more than what he was saying. Then, in April of 2024, things escalated. The district attorney convened a grand jury, and both Terry Rose and David Wiley were called to testify under oath. Terry stayed consistent, confident. He stuck to his version of events. But David told the same story, but this time he seemed uncomfortable and nervous, like the pressure was starting to get to him. And after his testimony, investigators reached back out to him, asking him if he would be willing to come in and take a polygraph test. David told detectives that they needed to contact his attorney, and then he hung up on them. And right there in that moment, red flags were flying. Because at this point, it felt clear David either knew something or he was involved in something. Then his attorney called the Beaumont Police Department, and what they said changed everything. They told investigators that David had information that could help solve the case and that he was ready to talk. But there was a catch. David would only speak if he was granted full immunity from prosecution, and that's a huge ask. So investigators needed a little bit more information. They needed to know how involved was he. Was he part of this or just someone who knew what had happened? According to his attorney, David didn't kill Kimberly, but he did know exactly what had happened to her. And with that, authorities made the decision. They granted David Wiley full immunity in exchange for the truth. They met with him at his attorney's office, and what he told them was something no one saw coming. David said that on July 9th, 1999, around 6:15 p.m., he got a call from Terry Rose. Terry asked him to pick him up from the local Walmart. He told David to call his cell phone when he was close so that he could give him the exact direction to where he was parked. When David arrived, he saw something unexpected. Terry was sitting inside Kimberly's car. When David pulled up next to him, Terry told him to follow him down the road, saying he didn't like that parking lot. David didn't question it, he just followed. They drove to another shopping center, the one where the Eckerds was located. That's where Terry parked Kimberly's car. He got out, climbed into David's truck, and David drove him home. Later that night, the two met up again to play pool. And the next morning, they even went out to breakfast together. And it was at that breakfast that everything changed. Out of nowhere, Terry told David what had happened. He said that while Kimberly was at his house, the two of them got into an argument and he shot her. After she was dead, he told David he placed her body under a slab in one of the bedrooms of his home. And that detail was shocking, because no one had ever suggested something like that before. To hear that she may have been buried inside the home under a slab, it was something investigators had never even considered. Days after giving the statement, David agreed to take a polygraph test, and he passed. According to the results, he was telling the truth about this story. To further back his story, there was an employee at Terry's tow trucking business that said in 1999 that he had seen Kim's car parked at Terry's. And remember, Terry's business was located on his large property where he lived. So this wasn't some random sighting. The employee said that they saw her car at around 5:50 p.m., but when they looked again around 6:20, it was gone. And according to David, Terry had called him at 6:15 to come pick him up. The timeline lined up. The details matched. And for the first time in over two decades, it felt like the truth was finally starting to come together. On June 10th, 2024, the Beaumont Police Department was finally granted a search warrant for Terry Rose's home. This time, they weren't going in alone. The FBI was brought in to assist, and together they began scanning the home using ground-penetrating radar, methodically checking each room, looking for anything hidden beneath the surface. But by the third day, something went wrong. The equipment malfunctioned, and that was when they called in Tim Miller, the founder of Texas EquiSearch. If you're not familiar with Tim, he's someone who has dedicated his life to finding missing people. He's helped locate dozens upon dozens of individuals over the years. And in this case, he was about to help bring answers to a family that had been waiting for over two decades. Within minutes of arriving on scene with his team and equipment, they found something. A spot in the second bedroom that stood out. What was beneath that tile floor didn't match the rest of the house, and that was all investigators needed. They grabbed sledgehammers and started breaking through the tile. Almost immediately, they noticed something strange. In one section, Terry had placed cinder blocks beneath the tile, and under those cinder blocks, there was a hollow space. Bit by bit, investigators and FBI agents got down on their hands and knees, removing the tile, pulling out cinder blocks, and carefully sifting through the dirt beneath. And then they started finding things. A keychain, a pair of sunglasses, and then small bones. Bones they believed to be toe bones. And finally, wrapped in a blanket beneath the dirt, they found Kimberly. After more than 20 years, she was finally found. And there was no question about what had happened to her. It was clear that she had a gunshot wound to the back of her head. On June 13th, 2024, Terry Rose was finally arrested for her murder. He was placed in an interrogation room and refused to speak. So investigators took a different approach. They brought in his wife, Violet. They told her the truth, that Kimberly had been found buried beneath the floor of one of the bedrooms. Up until that moment, Violet had believed that Terry was innocent. She had fully cooperated with investigators, even making lighthearted comments earlier about wishing she had cleaned the house before they searched it. But this time, everything changed. She was devastated because the reality hit all at once. The man she had married, the man that she had trusted, had been living with a secret for 25 years. And even more disturbing, the room that she had been sleeping in was the very place Kimberly had been buried, just feet away for decades. The betrayal, the shock, it's hard to even put into words. And while Violet had no idea what kind of man that she had been living with, that truth was now impossible to ignore. Then, just 1 week before Terry's trial was set to begin, his attorney approached the district attorney asking for a plea deal. The district attorney offered Terry a deal of 40 years in prison and no chance at appeals in exchange for a guilty plea. And for the family, that decision wasn't easy. There were mixed emotions, but ultimately they felt like it was the right choice because it meant that they wouldn't have to endure years of appeals, reliving the worst moments of their lives over and over again. Terry accepted the deal. In December of 2025, he was back in court for sentencing. During the hearing, David Wiley took the stand and testified about what Terry had told him all those years ago. Tiffany also testified, sharing what life had been like growing up without her mother. And she made one thing very clear. She did not believe 40 years was enough for what he had done. Then, in a moment no one expected, the prosecution played a recorded jail call between Terry and his son. And what was heard in that courtroom was chilling. In the recording, Terry said he wasn't a psychopath, that he had just quote-unquote messed up and had a bad day and killed Kimberly. He laughed, and then he started talking about Tiffany. He mentioned that Tiffany was now in her 40s and said that people die in their 40s and 50s all the time. Then he made a statement that is almost hard to even repeat. He told his son that when that day comes that Tiffany dies, he would send him a cup of his pee so that he could pour it on Tiffany's grave. It was cruel, it was callous, and completely devoid of any remorse. Because this is a woman who spent years fighting for answers about her mother, and that's how he chose to speak about her. It's hard to understand how someone could carry that much hatred toward a child, a teenager at that time, who had lost her mother because of him. And to make matters worse, Tiffany had to sit there in that courtroom and listen to it all. When it was the judge's turn to speak, she didn't hold back. She looked directly at Terry and said that while he claimed he wasn't a psychopath, killing someone you once cared about, burying them in your home, and then living on top of them for 25 years, that sounds like the exact definition of a psychopath. She even admitted that she wished she hadn't accepted the plea deal from the prosecution because she believed a jury would have convicted him and given him life or even 99 years. Then Tiffany gave her victim impact statement, and the entire time she stared him down. She told him how much he had taken from her, how much he had stolen, and Terry just sat there watching her with what some described as a pitiful look on his face, like he wanted to cry. But whether those tears would have been for Tiffany or for himself, we may never know. Because at the end of the day, this wasn't about him. This wasn't about Terry Rose. It was about Kimberly. Kimberly Langwell was a strong, hardworking woman who did everything she could to provide for her daughter. She was the kind of mom so many people wish they had. Loving, devoted, and deeply present in her daughter's life. And that's how she deserves to be remembered. Not for what was done to her, but for the life that she lived. My heart truly goes out to Tiffany and everyone who loved Kimberly. She seemed like an incredible woman. And while Terry will spend the rest of his life behind bars, it's hard not to wonder if he will ever truly feel the weight of what he's done. Because if history tells us anything, he likely still doesn't. Crimesters, that is all that I have for this week's episode. Make sure that you guys are a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I post all pictures and information pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. If you'd like to follow me on Instagram and keep up with what I have going on in my daily personal life, you can find me over there at Crimeaholly. And if you would like more bite-sized true crime content, you can find me on TikTok at crimewithholly.podcast. Thank you so much for being here, and I will catch you all next time. But until then, always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.